You know, that not knowing, like most things, that unknowability of it, the uncertainty of it, is more difficult to work around than, you know, than the fact or of someone's death.
Stories in his book include interactions with the people who actually constructed the flying saucers or who were seeking contact with extraterrestrial life. For the most part, people welcomed him into their circles as he took photos and recorded stories about their experiences.
And most times they viewed me as a harbinger, a messenger from the aliens. I remember one fellow, Wayne Aho, who ran a group at the foot of Mount St. Helens. And I went down there. They were going to create a cosmic brain battery to summon UFOs to land and, you know, joining hands with this metal pyramid at the center of this sacred circle. And I just show up on the doorstep and say, "Hi, I'm Doug Kern. I'm from Canada. I'm looking for people's ideas about outer space." And I didn't have to qualify what those beliefs were or my position, but they would just say, you know, like Wayne Aho did, said, "Come in," and knowing that if you're here, it's been preordained. So another time, I love this story. I was at a UFO convention in Reno, Nevada, and it's being held at the fairgrounds in the cattle barn. And so there's all these flying saucer people in this cattle barn still stinking of cow dung, and there's a big inflated flying saucer that someone's made out of mylar at the end of the room, and I'm there photographing, and these two matronly women come up and they're in their flower print dresses. I mean, they look like Iowa farm wives, right? And they said, "Can you tell us, where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from Saskatchewan." They said, "No, we've been watching you beyond that." And I said, "Well, I'm just a photographer from Saskatchewan." And they said, "We're so glad to see you, and we want to help you with your work." And they shook my hand, and inside they pressed a $10 bill. And it was one of those things, at some point you just, they'd say, you know, "You've been told or you've been sent here." And I'd just say, "Yes, and I'm here to make the pictures."
Although he stopped recording those folk stories of UFOs and extraterrestrials, he says he still enjoys watching his work spin off in unexpected ways as people encounter his book.
Just this summer, I got sent word of a folk artist who was inspired by In Advance of the Landing. And this is an interesting story, because she grew up thinking that her father was a complete wacko and a source of embarrassment. They grew up poor, hardworking people. And she had viewed her family and her father with a lot of embarrassment until one day she came across my book. And it suddenly let her see him in a whole different light. And from that, she's burgeoned in her own career and done all these paintings about alien visitation that was formed this one-person show that was very highly regarded this past summer.
Chapter 4. The Artist.
My dad was building flying saucers in Texas, and I didn't really know other people who did that.
This is Esther Watson.
There was, I think, about four or five of them, and they were building them in the garage, and they were made they had a, they were the elliptical shape, and they had an aluminum frame. He would create a frame, and then like one payday, he would show up with like giant roll of sheet aluminum instead of groceries, and then he would sheet and cover the entire saucer with aluminum. Some saucers he never finished. They would just have the framing on it, or they would have the propeller, and he would take the car engine out of our car and put it in the saucers to turn these propellers. But the irony is he couldn't keep his cars running. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't put oil in the car, or, you know, and then just, like, leave it on the side of the road, or it'd run out of gas. Or they were always breaking down, but he was building the future of transportation. I thought that was interesting.
She's an artist who now lives in California. She grew up in Texas. You might be familiar with her work. She's known for her graphic novel, Unlovable, which was based on a found diary. She also paints landscapes of the places she lived as a child in Texas. Casually included in these calm pastoral scenes, though, are flying saucers hovering just above cows and children playing in fields.
A lot of times when I got older, I was very embarrassed. I tried to act like I had nothing to do with that, you know, and I would stay away from it. He put an office chair in one of them, and we would all sit in it. He was really big into taking pictures of Polaroids, a Polaroid camera, I think because he was so impatient to wait for the film to be developed. But he would take all these pictures with a Polaroid camera. Sometimes he would have us pose inside of it, and he would send these pictures, to Ross Perot for funding, or, you know, whatever president was in office at the time, George Bush. Sometimes he was going to get rid of it because the design was flawed. But before he got rid of it, he wanted to make it look like a saucer crash. So he just kind of tilted it on its side and then crawled underneath it and had me take a photo with the Polaroid camera. But he had his pose. We don't have very many of those pictures because he either sent them off or, I don't know, we would move. We had to move often because the landlord didn't like him junking up the yard. Or he would get in a battle with the town because of city ordinance. He would just make a big mess and get fined. And he also, would tap electricity. Like, he'd tap into the electric line so that he could weld, and because our electricity would get shut off and our water would get shut off. And he taught us kids, you know, how to turn the water back on if it ever got shut off. Uh-huh.
When Esther eventually went away to school, the way she perceived her father changed. She stumbled across Doug's book.
And I was working in the library, and I came across Douglas Curran's book. And it was just filled with pictures all across the United States and Canada, of people who, for whatever reason, built saucers and sometimes spacesuits. Or my dad would build. He would make spacesuits as well. So I was just like, oh my gosh, there's other people out there, just like my dad. And it made me. It was kind of a relief in a way, because it was like, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. We're not alone, and because it was, you know, growing up, when, especially when I was a teenager, it was super embarrassing that he was doing this.
And suddenly, her father wasn't some weirdo that embarrassed her anymore. He was a visionary artist.
My sisters and I had run across Raw Vision magazine as well, and we saw that there was a name for this type of art, what we were calling art, because to me, I love to make art, so... It felt like what he was doing was visionary art. And even though I think for him he doesn't see it as art, I think he sees it more as like amateur engineering. And we even, the American Folk Art Museum sent us over to Italy one time to pick up one of his saucers to bring it back for the museum. And he was kind of confused because he was like, well, are scientists going to be looking at this? And I'm like, no, it's just, you know, people going to this art museum. And so he made like the ugliest saucer because it was for artists. So I think to him it's very separate. But I consider it, for me, looking at it, it's visionary art, and similar to a lot of what visionary artists do, and I'm sure a lot of visionary artists think they're doing something different than what I'm calling art. But
Esther began incorporating flying saucers into her own paintings. It's a folky style, and her art is also known as outsider art.
I moved upstate New York with my husband and young daughter, and I started painting these folk art New England landscapes, and I moved to California, and I realized, like, it was kind of, I was inspired by a lot of the folk art up there, but when I out in California, there was no point for me to paint these New England landscapes, and I started painting Texas landscapes with the saucers, and I was looking at a lot of like memory painters like Grandma Moses, who paint, you know, their childhood memories, even though they weren't perfect, but in an idealized way. And I really liked the idea of painting these childhood memories of dysfunction. And because we didn't have photo reference, and I like the idea of fallible memory too, that, you know, I was trying to remember all the different houses, and it kind of started too when my dad sent me, he was sending me letters after I had moved to college. He moved back to Italy, and he started sending me letters, and he would draw on the top of this one batch of letters, had a drawing of each giant saucer that he had built, car-sized saucer. And I think there were five of them. And he would write underneath, you know, why he built that saucer. And in his letter, it was always like, somebody shut it down. Somebody else shut it down. Like, the city of Wiley did not want a flying vehicle. And so he had to discard that saucer. And but I remember different things. I remember it differently. And so I thought it was really interesting to paint my version, my memory of those incidents when he built a saucer. And then, you know, the city of Wiley got mad because he was tapping into the electric wires directly and blew up a transformer and was costing the city money. And he welded the wire so that, you know, he could turn it on. They couldn't turn it off. And he has, like, very different reasons and memories for why that happened. I kind of liked that, exploring that.
Esther says she thinks she knows why her father was building those flying saucers all those years.
He was not into aliens at the time. This is the reason I think he built them. My dad was adopted from Calabria, Italy, when he was 7 years old, and he flew on a propeller plane to the United States, and later he made his way to Texas, and he was adopted by the Watsons, and grew up during the space race, and, you know, he had so much. He came from so little and had so much, and in high school, he was obsessed with building flying saucers because he saw that as the future of transportation. And in, like, after high school, he built a life-size one that he could fit in. And he had a teacher at, it was like an engineering school in Arkansas that was kind of like a mentor to him. And he built one that the propeller turned, and he says it flew a little bit off the ground. I think it just kind of hovered. And then we built a bunch more that were car size, and they were always meant to be these prototypes for transportation. And he never really talked about aliens, but he would, sometimes my mom would sew him spacesuits to protect him from negative ions. And but then sometimes he would go through a religious phase. He always kind of struggled with, you know, spending all this time working on this prototype and then, like, providing for his family. And so sometimes he would just scrap everything and then get a really good paying job and then become really very religious and try to stay on track.
And she has an idea of why he stopped building them.
But later in life, when he was in his mid-30s, he found his biological sister in Italy. And he moved back, and he moved all of us to Italy for a little while. And he kind of went back and forth for a little bit. And he eventually, after my parents divorced, he moved back permanently to be near his sister Rosa. And he, ever since he went back, he no longer builds those gigantic saucers. And for me, it was almost like this metaphor that he, like, built his own ship to go home. Make little experiments, and there is there's a community near Milan where he lives that they're more into UFO, they're into like aliens and UFOs, and you know they would show interest in what my dad was doing and his experiments, and so he started talking about aliens more when he found when that group showed interest.
And now flying saucers are being passed down to another generation.
My daughter associates flying saucers with me, and she really likes imagery that has flying saucers on it because it means mom, which is so odd to me. And several times throughout her life, you know, I love to take these road trips, and we'll do. I started making these lady saucers, the pink glittery saucers, and I used glitter because my daughter. At the time I first started painting those saucers, was really very, like, girly and loved glitter. And she was associating saucers with me, and so I was making these, like, girly lady saucers. They're like mom saucers. And and I would paint these paper plates and paint them pink with glitter. And then we would go out, and she would throw them in the air. I'm like, throw it in the air again. She's like, Mom, this is getting boring. And I would take lots of pictures. And then I would paint sometimes from those pictures. And even just recently, when we went to Salvation Mountain, you know, we found a rock that somebody had painted pink. And I was like, throw this rock in the air. Like, do it again. Do it again. She's like, Mom, it's getting boring. Come on. Go now. So I feel like, who knows? Maybe she'll continue. It's become like a family legacy.
Yeah.
When we were in San Francisco, we went to Creative Growth, which is this a really amazing foundation to help people with disabilities make art. And, you know, they can express themselves in all kinds of ways, you know, through sewing or cutting out shapes in wood and painting them, or just drawing, or and they all have different reasons. When you get to look at different, especially like outsider visionary or folk art or self-taught artists, you get to look at their work. They have this one message that they keep repeating and that they're talking about over and over. And I find that very relatable because I feel like my flying saucer paintings are very much like that as well. Like it's almost like repeating this memory or reframing a memory over and over and over. Yeah, and I definitely, I totally understand. I think there's something really, I don't know, powerful in that outsider artists do that so openly. Like, they talk about something that is very important to them so openly, whereas I feel like sometimes when some educated artists or artists that are in this have to kind of follow the establishment rules a little bit more and suppress their messaging or what it is they're trying to say.
Chapter 5, The Ones Who Watch the Sky. Granger and Esther's father, the people who call in to Art Bell's radio show, they're not alone. UFOBC.ca has a section with recently reported BC UFO sightings. It's updated monthly, and there is never a shortage of UFO sightings. The reports read like poetry. June 1st, 2016, Vancouver, BC, around midnight. There are about 7 or 8 orb-like lights, orange, red, and color, hovering over the ocean over Sunset Beach. They were moving in strange patterns, going up and down and back and forth. They were incredibly bright and would rise up, very high, and then fade out. Some would sink low and fade out. The whole event went on for about 20 minutes, with various orb-like objects appearing, moving around the sky in strange patterns, and then fading out. Can't explain it, and would love someone to take a look at the video and let me know what they think. It was truly breathtaking. Mid-February 2016, Nanaimo, BC. I have seen this a lot lately in Nanaimo. I noticed them in mid-February after I came home from work when it got dark, and I saw an orange light on the horizon towards the harbor. It was slowly hovering north, then another one appeared slowly beside it, then another one, then they disappeared in the same fashion. I see these lights often. I can distinguish the difference between planes coming in and these weird orange-yellow orb lights. 11th of June, 2016, Surrey, BC. Around 11 p.m., as my wife was about to retire for the evening on Saturday night, she observed a large spherical-shaped craft with lights around the periphery of the craft, visible through the evening's thin cloud cover as it hovered over Green Timbers Forest in Surrey. She said it appeared to be massive. It moved a little, but unlike any conventional aircraft, then slowly ascended further and further away until it was no longer visible at all. By the time she alerted me to what had happened, it had disappeared altogether. 13th of January, 2015. I saw 6 oval-shaped objects that appeared to drop out of the moon in the southwest sky. Each sped off in a northwest direction. The first appeared red, the second was darker and appeared to have a yellowish tail behind it. The next few appeared as dark ovals, but almost looked more triangular in shape as they sped away to the northwest. The first 2 ovals appeared to travel along the same line. The next few darker triangular shapes traveled in the same direction, but on slightly different paths. I honestly don't know what I saw. At first I thought my eyes were deceiving me, but I was awake and lucid, outside having a cigarette and staring up towards the moon. There was a break in the fog, and I saw what I've described above. 20th of January, 2015, February, Victoria, 2015, BC, Tagish Lake, Yukon. 16th of April, 2015, Balfour, 23rd BC. April, 2015, Fort St. James, BC. 3 orange lights going up like a Roman candle in slow motion. I saw a very bright light in the northwest sky. Roughly tube-shaped object with red pulsating light in front, or direction of travel. Yellow to orange underside. And on the way home, I noticed something huge towards my right, just hovering in one spot, with lights all the way around. And when I asked my friend what that was, early this morning, while looking south above, as I tried to drive back to the house, I spoke with a member of Cowichan RCMP about Granger as a missing person. Corporal Krista Hobday told me over the phone that the detachment no longer had files on Granger, but she dug a little deeper and discovered that he's no longer considered a missing person. This is significant because missing person files are open until the person is found. However, I couldn't find a death certificate for him either. The fragment from a file she was able to pass on was a line or two about when his vehicle was found. It was blown to bits and human bone fragments were found amongst the debris. This led them to assume Granger Taylor was dead and the case was closed. There was no DNA testing done. Granger Taylor was a misunderstood man who wanted to join extraterrestrials on a journey through the universe. Esther Watson's father was searching for a way home. I think we're all looking for a little something extra in this life. A bit of magic to counterbalance the mundane and sad. And I think Doug sums it up the best.
When I set out to do the book, and people Often people will ask me, well, do you believe in flying saucers? I said, I never cared about flying saucers. What interested me was the aspect of hope. It's the need to believe. And to find that same human need to believe, to frame our existence within a larger context, that interested me. That's what I wanted the book to do, to talk about this continuity of human need. And so the book's never been about whether or not flying saucers or alien beings exist. It's actually not very interesting to me.
Right.
What was interesting was this continuity of the human experience and this need for hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these people from Al Thomas, who constructed a flying saucer to distribute food, medicine, and the Bible, when he's up there talking away in his Arkansas drawl and said, you know, I'll misquote from my book. It's been some years, some of this stuff. But he says, you can take airplanes, carbon arc welding, anything, but you get to the word of the Lord, that's got it all beat. And he's up there prancing around on this lopsided flying saucer that he's built out of scrap sheet metal and tubing from a junkyard. And he's connected to a bigger vision of his life in the world. And at some point, you know, I gained a lot of admiration for these people. Because while I didn't have to agree with their belief, I saw that it was ultimately, in one form or another, life-giving.
This was Beam Me Up, a documentary produced by me, Liz MacArthur. Thanks to the people whose voices are heard in the documentary. The clips at the beginning of the documentary are from recordings of Art Bell's call-in radio show, Coast to Coast AM, used without permission. This documentary was made possible with funding from CJSF 90.1 FM and the Canadian Radio Fund of Canada.
This is Bird Note. Every spring, millions of people hang up hummingbird feeders to attract and feed these avian wonders. And every fall brings the question, when do I take down my feeders? If I leave them up too late in the season, do I put my hummingbirds at risk of missing the right moment to migrate, exposing them to the hazards of winter? Here's the general answer. Providing food for hummingbirds in the fall will not cause them to overstay their normal migration schedule. That timing is driven largely by hormonal response to the length of the day. Leaving feeders out won't tempt them to procrastinate. It may even help to leave feeders hanging for a week or two after you've seen the last hummingbird of the season, just in case a late migrant stops by to fatten up. For those who live on the Pacific coast, however, it's a little different. The species known as Anna's hummingbird is largely non-migratory, residing year-round from California to southern British Columbia. If you have Anna's hummingbirds in your neighborhood, they will benefit from the food you provide any day of the year. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers established the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.